Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I am Charlie Sykes. Today may be the last day of the impeachment of Donald J. Trump. Lots of hot takes out there about how this is ending not with a bang, but with a whimper. I actually apologize for using that phrase myself yesterday. I actually think that's wrong. I think there's going to be considerable blowback on all of this. But there are so many different angles to talk about. And so we are very fortunate to be joined by Kim Whaley, a contributor to the Bulwark and our resident constitutional scholar on this particularly fraught Friday. Good morning.
Morning, Charlie.
Okay, that's this. Anyway, just for people who understand, Kim is a visiting professor and fellow in law and government at American University's Washington College of Law. She's a professor at the University of Baltimore School of Law, former assistant U.S. attorney and associate independent counsel in the Whitewater investigation, and the author of How to Read the Constitution and Why. I think you're going to have to revise that, don't you think, now?
Maybe. I hope not. I hope I'm not having to teach a class in, you know, postmodern constitutionalism. But I think we might be there, Charlie.
So let's just start with the breaking news as of this taping. I was not at all surprised that Lamar Alexander voted no on witnesses. It's just not in his DNA to break with Cocaine Mitch or to cast the decisive vote against Donald Trump, given the dynamics of Republican politics and Senate politics. But clearly came as a huge disappointment to folks who really did think that there would be Republicans who would think that, yes, if you're going to have an impeachment trial, you ought to hear from witnesses, as every other impeachment trial in American history has done. I think virtually, maybe there was one that did not. But it looks like as we're speaking that they will not have the votes. We don't know what Lisa Murkowski is going to do. I think we can get into this, but I think the chances of Chief Justice Roberts casting a decisive vote are slim and none. Which means that we are probably 24 hours away from the end of the trial. No witnesses, no subpoenas, no evidence, and the acquittal of the president. So, Kim, before we get into the piece, this very provocative piece you have up on the Bulwark, your thoughts about the decision by the Republicans to reject any witnesses, because earlier this week, that seemed very unlikely. We have polls showing more than 70% of Americans thinking that we ought to hear the witnesses. In this polarized environment, you never get 70% favoring anything. So it's an interesting political and constitutional move by the Republicans.
Well, politically, we'll have to see, given that poll number, whether members of the Senate who voted against witnesses are held accountable in their own races for re-election. And of course, if the Senate goes Democrat, that's a blow to Trump if he ends up in the White House for the second term. I mean, Americans understand what a trial is. This isn't really a question of constitutional law. It doesn't require understanding where Ukraine is and what a quid pro quo is and what the GAO said about the Impoundment Act, etc. People understand a trial is about facts and determining what actually happened. And the Republicans have had sort of various versions of factual, really, excuses for what happened here. And all along have said, listen, we don't have any direct evidence that Donald Trump in his brain, we heard a lot about this silly mixed motive defense, but in his brain meant to sway the election. Therefore, this is not a basis for removal. And Americans understand that that's a little too cute for common sense, that. If you don't have anything to hide, let's hear from John Bolton. Let's hear from Milk Mulvaney. Let's hear from even Lev Parnas. And then they can acquit. But the American people, both for purposes of this vote in the next couple days and for purposes of November 2020, their vote then, deserve to know all the facts of what happened. And right now, some of the key information about Donald Trump's firsthand knowledge is locked in the upper echelons of his cabinet. And that's you know, illogical, A, and also just a frightening prospect going forward when it comes to having an accountable White House.
this, of course, is the big question in terms of the precedents and how Donald Trump interprets this and whether he's emboldened, empowered. And we know how he reacted last time, that he thought that he had skated on the Mueller report. But for a moment, I want to stick with Lamar Alexander, who is leaving the Senate. And I think people thought that he might look at his legacy. He's often talks about Howard Baker as his mentor. I think it's safe to say that Lamar Alexander is no Howard Baker, and I think he's going to be remembered for all of this. But having said all of this, there is one thing that I thought was surprising about the statement last night, or at least I found it. This was not totally what I was expecting. Alexander says he's not going to vote for witnesses, but in effect, if you read his statement, he really breaks with that perfect call narrative. So, in saying why he's against witnesses, his case is that he didn't need more evidence because it was already so obvious that Trump was guilty as charged. I mean, just read what he writes. There is no need for more evidence to prove the president asked Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden and his son Hunter. He said this on television on October 3rd and during his July 25th telephone call with the president of Ukraine. There is no need for more evidence to conclude the president withheld U.S. aid, United States aid, at least in part to pressure Ukraine to investigate the Bidens. The House managers have proved this with what they call a mountain of overwhelming evidence. And then he goes on to say that, yes, this is wrong. It was inappropriate for the president to ask a foreign leader to investigate his political opponent and to withhold United States aid to encourage that investigation. When elected officials inappropriately interfere with such investigations, it undermines the principle of equal justice under the law. So this is the defense that was the easiest, I think, defense for Republicans, senators, but it's one that the Trump basically said, no, you can't acknowledge that I did it. There was, this was a perfect phone call. It didn't happen. So it is kind of interesting that in this statement, Lamar Alexander says, yeah, he did everything that was charged. I just don't think that it rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors. It's inappropriate, but I don't think that it rises to the level of the Senate needing to remove him from office. So is that a contradiction, yeah, or is that a defensible position?
I mean, I think this is what makes it particularly chilling. It's not even a pretense that this was a perfect call, or we first heard no quid pro quo. Then for a while, we heard rooting out corruption in Ukraine. Then we heard that we wanted burden sharing. I mean, all of these excuses have kind of fallen by the wayside. And some of us have been saying from the beginning that the only legitimate defense is the who cares defense. And then we had Alan Dershowitz, who's not a constitutional scholar. I mean, you don't go to podiatrist for heart surgery. I mean, he's a criminal lawyer and a criminal expert and a professor. I mean, that's legitimate, but constitutional law is different. But he got out on the Senate floor and essentially made this astonishing argument that what the president believes is in his own best interest is in the best interest of the country and unimpeachable, essentially condoning the powers of a monarch. And I think it frankly gave, I personally breathed a sigh of relief because it was like, okay, finally we're putting on the table the reality of what is at stake for the Constitution. But it kind of backfired for me, frankly, because I think it gave Lamar Alexander and Senate Republicans breathing room to hide behind a scholar to basically say, yeah, this is what we're doing. We are condoning and sanctioning no limits on the power of the presidency and handing over, by virtue of the second article of impeachment challenging obstruction of Congress, handing over, getting on down on our hands and knees to the president going forward. And we heard yesterday too, Pat Philbin, counsel for the president, made the argument that several questions was, what are left of the limits? And he said, okay, well, we have appropriations power. Well, of course we know President Trump flouted Congress's appropriations power by withholding the aid. We have the power to legislate. Well, we know that the president has flouted legislation by ignoring the requirement under the Empowerment Control Act that he notify Congress when we've held the aid. They said, well, we have the advice and consent power. We can withhold nominees. That's a power we have left. Well, the president of the United States has used Rudy Giuliani to do foreign policy on his behalf and bypass the advice and consent clause. They said, well, we can hold hearings, oversight hearings. Well, that's the second article of impeachment. Their attempts to hold oversight in the House were met with complete stonewalling. You can't do oversight without facts. And the Supreme Court's made that clear since the 1920s. So essentially, this Congress is saying we are giving up any oversight of the presidency. And the problem is, you know, you might love this president, but this is going to lead to tyranny and violations of individual rights. Even if you're on Team Trump, it's changed the job description for the presidency, that one day there will be a president in office that will make decisions that you believe violate your rights, unless we have a future president that comes in and says, listen, I know I've been given all this power, but I, like, kind of like George Washington, I'm not going to take the mantle of kingdom of being a king. I will give it up for the sake of the country. And so far, as you indicate with Lamar Alexander, there aren't many patriots in office right now that are willing to fall on their own sword for the sake of the country. And my guess is Lamar Alexander doesn't want to go home to his constituents and be shunned at the grocery store for having stood up against this president.
Yeah, Tim Alberta has just a fantastic Twitter thread where he talks about, you know, all the pressures, even on a 79-year-old retiring senator.
Yeah,
the fact that you it's not just that your political career would be damaged, but your entire social universe would be affected by all of this. And you know, in your point about future presidents, this is where you would think that just normal human prudence would kick in, and that the Republicans would be thinking, how would we feel if a President Bernie Sanders exercises this kind of power, or an Elizabeth Warren exercises this kind of power? Well, again, one more thing on Lamar Alexander, though, because by the middle of the week, as you point out, the Republicans seem to be settling in on the so what defense, that, yeah, he did everything that he's accused of doing. We now know that. No big deal. So what? I don't think that's what Lamar Alexander was saying. I mean, can we make a distinction here?
Right. No, I think that's morphed. Okay. I think you're right. It's the this is okay defense.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas Lamar Alexander says yes, he did it, but we're not going to remove him from office, which strikes me as a much more, you know, more sober position, at least saying it is wrong. It is inappropriate to do that. And I kind of wonder how that is going to play in the White House. And I wonder whether other Republicans are going to say it. But that strikes me as a different answer than the so what answer, because that's kind of like the performative Trumpism that we're seeing, you know, from people like Martha McSally and Joni Ernst, which is, screw it. You know, president wants to do that. That's completely okay.
Yeah. And the Milk Mulvaney, get chilling. Over it. Yeah,
right.
The get over it comment, that this is just the new normal. I mean, I think that's right. But, I can't say that. I mean, of course, for a lot of reasons, to punt it to the next election, we can talk about that, is a bit cynical in my mind from Lamar Alexander. I mean, I think if that's your position, you have to back it up with actual consequences. And one of the biggest issues with respect to impeachment in this moment is that the next election, from, you know, Robert Mueller, by every expert's account, is being influenced by the Russians. Mitch McConnell has stopped any legislation going to the Senate floor to protect the integrity of American democracy. And Donald Trump has publicly invited foreign interference. The narrative here is that Lamar Alexander is saying is okay, is about interference in the election. So, you know, the big kind of question is, okay, Lamar Alexander, you're okay then with whatever happens in November 2020, Americans can't be confident that their votes are meaningful. That's the issue.
Well, yeah, and I also think, and I could be completely wrong on all of this, that I do think that Republicans are underestimating the blowback on this vote on witnesses. I think that the safer political move would have been, sure, let's listen to the witnesses, let's look at the evidence, and then if we decide that the president, has not committed a high crime and misdemeanor, then you move on. And, you know, theoretically, the base would be okay with that. And yet the decision to essentially say, yeah, we don't even want to hear what's out there, I think is a toxic vote. And I think that it's going to be a very difficult position for people like Cory Gardner and Martha McSally and Joni Ernst, even Tom Tillis, to make, because it does look like obstruction. It does look like a cover up. And I also think it does taint the legitimacy of the verdict. Because it's an acquittal, but it's not an exoneration. So, you know, what a week ago looked like it was going to be a pretty easy, spike the football. The president has been acquitted. He's been vindicated. I think it's going to be much more, I think it's going to be much more complicated and much more difficult, especially for those vulnerable senators. So Mitch McConnell did, in the end, bet the Senate majority on Trumpism. And I usually think he's a savvy operator, but I don't think he understands the extent of the anger and the kind of head scratching a trial without witnesses. That just doesn't sound right.
Well, and the other wrinkle here, Charlie, is the information is going to continue to come out. I mean, they're not going to be able to keep a lid on people like Lev Parnas and John Bolton spilling the beans in other ways. The dirt on, so to speak, Donald Trump will continue to leak out. And the question will be, why are we hearing from this now? This could have been part of the process now that the trial is closed and we're still hearing from it. Why didn't you have a fair, thorough process so we can all move on with our lives? I agree with you. And the argument that, well, you know, and we can get to my piece, but the argument that the Democrats should have done more, I've been very clear from a lawyer's perspective that they should have done more in terms of just taking off the table the, well, you could have gotten facts in the House process through subpoena power. I agree with that. That being said, the huge difference here that with Clinton, for example, that I worked on with Ken Starr in the Whitewater investigation is a grand jury with 4 years of factual subpoena power to gather this information. Why didn't we have that with respect to Ukraine? Attorney General William Barr. Mm. It was up to him to appoint a special prosecutor the way Rod Rosenstein did with Mueller. And not only did he not appoint a special prosecutor, he oversaw the decision, you know, not to turn over the whistleblower complaint, went to the Justice Department from the DNI, and they said, no, you're not legally required to turn it over. So the now House Democrats, you know, they had a lot of strategic decisions to make. Hindsight is 2020, but they were hamstrung from day one to get these facts out. And I agree. I think it's really cynical and short-sighted. I mean, it just doesn't pass the straight face test that there's a legitimate reason other than a political one to protect the president for not having witnesses at this point, particularly someone like John Bolton, who has firsthand knowledge and is willing and waiting to come and tell the American people what he knows.
Okay, so let's talk about your piece today, because it is quite provocative and getting a lot of buzz. The headline is, "Impeachment was the right call, but doing it this way was not. House Democrats' strategic errors have damaged the constitutional tool of impeachment." And you write that generations of historians will excavate what went wrong with the impeachment process this time around. And of course, you're not letting the Republicans in the Senate off the hook in any way, but you do think that the Democrats made some serious mistakes. So talk about that. What was the major error by House Democrats?
Well, the major error, which I said back in December, was to not use the federal courts to shore up the subpoena power. Basically, the Democrats and said, we're not going to bother subpoenaing witness based on Pat Cipollone's letter saying that impeachment's unconstitutional and we're not going to comply. We're not going to move to compel subpoenas for documents because it'll take too long. We'll just go to impeachment. And the problem with that is we heard over and over again for the last week, a couple weeks with trial, well, you know, the Democrats had the power and they didn't use it. And it's not right to expect the Senate to clean up what the Democrats didn't do. I mean, there's some sort of a logical appeal to that. But the bottom line is there is no federal authority for complete immunity for witnesses in the White House. Zero. I mean, this is a lay down in the courts. This is the easiest, lowest hanging fruit any lawyer could ask for. You have two Supreme Court decisions involving Nixon and Clinton that said that presidents don't have absolute immunity. I mean, this is not complicated. And I mean, my strategy would have been, you know, subpoena everybody under the sun, move to compel, and then you'll get lots of federal judges. By definition, they have no choice backing up the subpoena power, and then still impeach on the same schedule. So that, I think, was a strategic error. Number
right.
two.
Well, you know what the blowback was on all of that. And I made that case once on television, and I was contacted by a prominent Democratic congressman who then explained to me, Congress explained to me that, well, this would mean, you know, 6 months delay. It would be tied up in court. It would basically, you would lose all of your momentum and everything. You don't feel that it would have been, that it would have delayed the entire process, that it would have been in court for 6 months?
Couple things. One is there's no reason that Democrats had to wait for the appeals to go all the way to the Supreme Court. They could have gone to impeachment with their district court decisions that the president continued to flout and ignore and say, listen, we've done everything we could do. They'd still say, well, you should wait for appeal. So that's number one. Number two is Pat Philbin made the argument, well, you know, we've complied through FOIA requests, a FOIA request for documentation from the OMB did make its way through the courts in time to make it into the public sphere of the information. Number three, and Trump is really good at this. He's had multiple expedited appeals through his presidency, and that could have been the argument. Listen, we need you, Supreme Court, appellate courts, to hear this right now. Urgently, the American public needs it. So you know, the courts can move quickly if they have to, but to sort of basically back down and stand up and just say, we're not going to even try to fight the bully, I just don't think what is the best strategy. And I think it did backfire.
Yeah.
For the Democrats. You could just keep impeach, even though the cases are pending on appeal.
Well, and as you wrote this morning, you know, if those efforts had proceeded in tandem, the impeachment and the litigation, the Democrats would hardly be worse off than they were on Thursday, begging Republicans to allow just one more week of depositions so that they could hear from people like John Bolton. You say that, you know, obviously it's no excuse for the Republicans.
No.
But it was a mistake. So what is your, you know, I think what you're saying is, I agree with you. So why do you think Democrats made that decision? Because it seems I thought at the time it seemed hasty and ill-advised, but in retrospect, it's like, what was the point of all that? Particularly when Nancy Pelosi then after the impeachment held it for several weeks. So it was rush, rush, rush. We can't even issue subpoenas because it's so urgent we pass this. Then they delay it. And then they, you know, have it basically thrown back in their face in the Senate. So why do you think they made that judgment?
I mean, I think it's I've asked this question many times. And the answer I've gotten is the one that you got, which is we didn't want to wait for appeals. But that assumes you'd have to wait for appeals. You couldn't ask for an expedited. You know, I think the argument was also, listen, we'll just ping the president for obstruction. And maybe, you know, we've also heard from some, you know, sort of conservative pundits, including Jonathan Turley, who I'm go head to head with all the time on CBS as legal analysts, that, you know, that's not a legitimate article of impeachment because the president has a right to defend himself in court. Lawyers don't have a right to defend themselves or to make arguments that are indefensible under the law. There is a good faith requirement, and that is not what happened here. So I think they might have assumed that there would have been sort of more good faith in how lawyers for Trump and that are on the taxpayer dollar would have defended this in court. I mean, Adam Schiff is absolutely right. At the same time, they're saying you should have gone to court. They're in court right now saying, oh, by the way, you can't move to compel because there's no standing and impeachment is the only way that you can hold a president accountable for violating subpoenas. It's a heads we win, tails you lose situation. It's untenable for the separation of powers. And I just want to be really clear. I mean, I am outraged and frankly disgusted by how the Republicans have handled this process. But I do think, you know, there has to be really strong, you know, fight from the Republicans from a legal standpoint as well. I mean, I just think that they should have been very aggressive across the board, fighting everything possible in court. To have the courts basically stand up for the Constitution and not just Adam Schiff and the House managers.
It was a lack of political will at a certain point. I remember back in December, I wrote something where I said it almost feels like the Democrats were sort of half-assing it, as opposed to, you know, you're going after the president on abuse of power. And instead of going and turning over every single stone, there seemed to be almost a sense of political panic. Let's just get this done. Let's get it through. We don't want to wallow with it. I think that it was concern that maybe this was going to be hurting vulnerable Democrats. And it almost felt like they were going through the, let's just do it. Let's check the box without necessarily doing all the due diligence. So I think there was, you know, obviously the political decision to launch impeachment. But I think that there was a little bit of wobbliness that led to this decision, that I don't think it was completely substantive. I think a lot of it was political. Okay, so that's my theory. I don't know. Okay, so the first one was not going after all of the witnesses, not trying to compel the subpoenas. And then your second point is that, you know, besides failing to push for fuller facts during the inquiry, you say the Democrats left themselves unnecessarily vulnerable in their drafting of the two articles of impeachment that are now being debated in the Senate. What do you mean? How did they leave themselves vulnerable with those articles?
Well, we have heard all through the process this sort of theoretical debate that most scholars think is not a debate. That is that you can't impeach for abuse of power without a crime. Can't impeach without a crime. You need a crime. You need a crime. You need a crime. Well, the second article of impeachment under 18 U.S. Code, obstruction of Congress, is a crime. That is a crime. So I don't understand why that statute wasn't cited in the article of impeachment. Take the argument off the table that this is just a purely political charge. It is not a purely political charge. And lawyers do raise claims, causes of action without citing statutes. But this would have just taken that political argument off the table, knowing it was coming. The other thing is, you know, I didn't mention this in the article. I think there will be longstanding debate whether under Article 1, they did, in fact, allege bribery, which is more like extortion. Adam Schiff has moved off of that. I think that's understandable in part because the Supreme Court has raised the bar for proving bribery as a criminal matter. And I think politicians are smart to be careful about opening themselves up to bribery charges through an impeachment process. But under Article 1 for abuse of power, we do have something that got Andrew Johnson in trouble, violating and ignoring an act of Congress. That's the Impoundment Control Act. The statute required the President of the United States to let Congress know if he was not going to release the aid. Mitch McConnell himself said over the summer he didn't know about this. Congress has the appropriations power. Congress decides how the executive branch gets to spend taxpayer dollars. That's one of the critical elements of control over the White House or oversight. And so if they had put that in there, right, in the Article 1 of impeachment, then senators would have to be basically voting expressly on a decision to basically say to the presidency, you know what, we pass legislation, but it's optional for you. You can ignore it if you want. And I think by not making that very explicit, that they didn't have the opportunity to hammer that argument in a way that it could have boxed Republicans in more in basically letting the president have a pass on this. And I mean, of course, hindsight's 20/20. I'm not, you know, the genius of strategy. And the piece is not intended to sort of attack Democrats. It's more of a kind of, you know, a strategy thought piece.
Yeah, the Impoundment Control Act, though, is not a criminal statute, and there's no penalties attached to it, but at least it would have identified an area of the law that he violated.
But I think from a separation of power standpoint, exactly, that's a great point, Charlie. It's not a crime. But from a separation of power standpoint, it's significant. They could have also talked about the federal campaign violations that, FEC Chair Ellen Weintraub identified. It is illegal to accept foreign aid in a campaign, even if it's not monetary. But what I'm saying is, you know, the presidents are not free to completely flout federal judges' orders. They're not free to completely flout statutes. The idea of the checks and balances is, you know, we have three heads of government, three entities that basically govern, ensure that we can govern ourselves. And so Congress does have to push back. If the president says, listen, we as Congress have the right to declare establish laws, and you have to follow them. You're bound by them. I mean, that's a constant power struggle with the presidency. And I think that would have helped here to make it clear what this president is trying to do.
You know,
I'm above the law.
You also make the fundamental point that, and I think we've learned this over the last, few months, is the tool of impeachment is vitally important. I mean, it really is important as to make the Constitution operative, to have checks and balances, to constrain the power of the president, to make it clear he's not above the law. And when you do it wrong, you damage that tool. And one of the problems of all of this is that it may essentially render impeachment useless. I mean, that's
right. And this gets to your rush point, you know, this like quick and dirty impeachment point. You know, Bill Clinton was impeached but not removed. And part of the argument was that, you know, he lied about his extramarital affairs. That was a personal abuse of in his personal life with, you know, and it's an employee when it came to Monica Lewinsky. But it wasn't using the public, the massive power of his office to entrench his own power. And the argument here has been, well, abuse of office alone isn't enough without a crime. Trump did abuse his office. And as I said, there was a crime there, but it wasn't articulated. So it's kind of a checkmate for impeachment. What's left? And really, it's like, you know, I've used this analogy many times. I mean, if there's a speed limit says you have to go 35, but you're on a country road and there's no cops around, you're going to go 55. The speed limit doesn't stop you unless there's a consequence. And I think we have to ask ourselves, what is the consequence for violating the scope of the office of the presidency, the scope of that power? What's the ticket for speeding? And I don't think the threat of impeachment is going to worry Donald Trump going forward. That's going to be a big shrug based on how this Senate looks like it's going to endorse his activity. And, you know, the power of that office gets handed to the next person and the next person. So future presidents can say, you know, this isn't really a threat anyway, because I have unlimited power if I can frame it as a policy decision or my own belief that this is best for the American public.
So what happens next? What should Congress do? I've seen a number of commentators who say, okay, so we've had this sham trial in the United States Senate, but the House Democrats should continue to aggressively investigate, should continue now to push to get more of this information out into the public record, you know. But without impeachment as the weapon, is that really a viable alternative, or is it basically the only thing they have left, and therefore they ought to do it anyway?
Well, it's the only thing they have left, and transparency is absolutely vital to a functioning democracy. So, you know, back to my other point that, you know, aggressive oversight is really important, particularly when you're dealing with a bully. You know, I believe whether it's through the impeachment or just legislative oversight, which I think even, you know, Trump's lawyers have sort of made the argument they have more subpoena power that way than through impeachment. I think there should be full on, you know, hearings and legislative oversight of everything that's happening in this administration that is a deeply problematic for the rule of law and the separation of powers. I mean, there was a stunning opinion that came out last week out of the Seventh Circuit under Judge Easterbrook, who's highly, highly respected appeals court judge, involving a case under immigration law. He issued an order and the Justice Department turned around and apparently directed people within the immigration community to ignore it. I mean, this is very, very dangerous. If you have a world where, you know, I mean, the framers wanted to get away from a situation where the king, whatever the king says, is the law. And that's what's at stake right now. And I think all hands have to be on deck and pulling back on unlimited powers of the presidency if we as Americans, individuals, are going to retain our individual rights.
Yeah. Now, in terms of what happens next, I mean, it is kind of extraordinary how fast events are going to be taking place, that this vote is going to take place. It'll be over by the end of Saturday. On Sunday, the president sits down for his pre-Super Bowl interview, and Fox has decided to send Sean Hannity, which tells you a little bit about the way Fox is operating these days. And then you have the president delivering, again, one of these extraordinary theater moments, his State of the Union address in front of Congress, having been, quote-unquote, acquitted by the United States Senate. I mean, that should be, you know, an extraordinary moment. And looming over all of this, as we've mentioned before, Lordy, there are more tapes. We are getting more of these Lev Parnas tapes. There are more Freedom of Information requests out there. The John Bolton book is going to drop one way or another, I think by March. We don't know what other things are going to come out. We've been told that the, you know, Southern District of New York is still investigating Rudy Giuliani. And of course, Donald Trump is the big wild card. How will he interpret this acquittal, and what will he do?
And do we get his tax returns finally, Charlie? I mean,
oh, good grief.
I don't know what's happening with that, but, you know, documents don't lie.
So I am unclear on one thing, though. Can Trump block the Bolton book? You know how publishing works. This book is supposed to come out in March, which tells me that it's on the press now, that it's done or close to being done. So does this threat have a reasonable chance of actually stopping Bolton from publishing this book?
Well, it's like we're talking about, I mean, what's the consequence? What's the pushback? The question is, what power, and I haven't done the analysis under sort of national security sort of clearance laws, but what is the power of the president to stop it? It would be some kind of legal threat. I mean, he could presumably go to court and seek an injunction to prevent the publisher from publishing it.
That's prior restraint. That's very difficult, isn't it?
But there are limits on the First Amendment rights when it comes to national security. I have to believe, you know, it's not like, I mean, there are plenty of circumstances where people that have access to top secret information can't go around blabbing it. I mean, there are limits on that. So, but I have to believe that, you know, John Bolton, who's a career person in the national security arena, knew what he was doing when he put things in that book. He knows those laws better than I do. But we have an emboldened president that it does not, you know, isn't shy about using threats, whether legitimate or not, to protect himself and to get what he wants. And John Bolton's a tough guy. It'll be very interesting to see how he stands up to Trump.
This is what I didn't fully understand, because my understanding was going to be very hard for them to actually have the courts block the publication. I mean, we do have the Pentagon Papers precedent out there, that the main threat was, we can sue you and do bad things to you afterwards if you violated all of this.
Right.
And whether that would be enough to dissuade John Bolton, who is about to make a ton of money. And it will be interesting to see how Bolton interprets all of this. You know, I'm a declared Bolton skeptic, although obviously that's had to be revised in this last week. But John Bolton has got to understand that when he speaks out, It will be he will be excommunicated from the conservative movement. There should be no doubt about, you know, how any sort of dissent is now being treated on the right. That the only thing that matters is your loyalty to Donald Trump. And so you saw this pivot within 24 hours from people who have known him and admired him and regarded him as this foreign policy icon for 20 years, and suddenly he's the bad guy. He's the Judas. And so the question is, you know, how far does he want to go? How much is he willing to do? And, how he's going to interpret the events of the next 24, 48 hours. But I think just as you want to talk about patriots, it's now up to him, isn't it? It is.
Yeah. And he's the darling of the progressives, who were horrified, I think, when he was appointed national security advisor. But I thought it was really interesting. I don't know if you picked this up, Charlie, when the House or the Senate chaplain gave the prayer yesterday. He talked about, you know, asking for, you know, for divine strength in combating fear. And I thought that was really, really interesting, because that is, I mean, we all know the notion that Donald Trump didn't do something that is impeachable or removable or is wrong and seriously dangerous to American democracy is laughable. I mean, you know, we know this, it's common sense. And so what is stopping people from acting with coherence and, you know, legitimate fact and law based common sense? And a lot of it is fear. It's fear, as you mentioned, of being kind of blackballed from the party. It's fear of losing financial endorsements and accessibility to that after you leave office. It's fear of losing office. That's, I think, a new frontier with this presidency that I don't think any president, and I don't know, I haven't been alive since the beginning of the Republic, has had this kind of grip on one party that eclipses integrity, eclipses rational thinking, eclipses loyalty to the people and the Constitution.
Yeah, I mean, going back to this Tim Alberta thread about what you're describing here is, you know, he spent a lot of time talking with Republicans and trying to explain why even somebody retiring doesn't feel liberated. And he says, look, you know, if anything, they're even more cowed and cautious, fearing that being out of favor with the president and his party limits their earning power. You know, you're not going to get a think tank job. You might not be named to a corporate board if you're in a feud with the president. And it's not just about money. I've had numerous retiring R's talk warily, sometimes fearfully, about the cult of Trump supporters back home. They worry about harassment of their families, loss of standing in local communities, estranged relationships. So, I mean, he's not defending this. He's just saying this is part of the reality. But I guess the bottom line is that at a certain point, just being afraid does not explain the self-abasement that's going on. At a certain point, the decision to behave dishonorably is a choice. And there are just not enough excuses. And I guess it is the disappearance of the folks like John McCain who, you know, would just stand up and say, look, this is just wrong. I'm not taking this position.
Right.
That's one of the remarkable things of our times.
Right. And it's just kind of a crisis of compassion and courage. I mean, where are the people with courage? I mean, there's a great book called How Democracies Die that's been, you know, gotten a lot of coverage. And it talks about how democracies across the globe, functioning democracies, have turned into tyrannical dictatorships historically. And there are various steps that they take, including attacking the press and co-opting the people in your party and, you know, instilling violence from the bully pulpit. And, you know, they make the very, very compelling argument that you check all those boxes with this particular president. And I think people need to understand American democracy isn't protected by some divine guardian angel from something that looks more like a dictatorship. We are vulnerable to it because we're human. And there are lots of forces, I think, that are working in that direction. And people should join hands as we the people, not we the Democrats or we the Republicans, and protect this precious, precious gift that we have in America of self-government. And unfortunately, we're not seeing people stand up. I mean, I think Adam Schiff will be American hero in the long term. I mean, we don't have more people like him standing up for the rule of law. I don't think what the Democrats did in this was political. I think this was about sustaining a viable democracy going forward. And I'm not so sure what our future is.
Kim Whaley, thank you for joining me again on this particularly interesting day for the U.S. Constitution, and thank you for spending so much time with us on the podcast.
Always a pleasure. Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.